I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. How much good can good design do? We aim to find that out on today's Smart City. The Urban Omnibus is a multimedia collection of insights from journalists, scholars, architects, artists, and citizens on the built environment of New York City. We'll speak with Kasim Shepherd, who manages the project, about creating an online conversation that reveals the choices that shape the city. We'll also speak with Dr. Richard Farson. His book, The Power of Design, says that designers can make a whopping impact on social dilemmas such as poverty, prison overcrowding, and educational failure. We'll ask him about the designer's role in shaping a better world. All that, plus our regular contributors, Walker Smith, and the latest news from Nate Berg at PlanEdison. Stick around for today's Smart City right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. An omnibus is an anthology, a collection of works of one author or of one subject. My first guest is creating an anthology of New York City called Urban Omnibus. Kasim Shepherd is the project manager for the site, which gathers the insights of journalists, scholars, architects, artists, and citizens, and creates a picture of New York unlike any other. You say that Urban Omnibus wants to create a new conversation about design and New York City. What kind of conversation is that?
It's a conversation that, as I see it, kind of breaks down a lot of the silos into which a lot of the most interesting innovations that are happening across all kinds of urban design and landscape architecture, city government, real estate, community activism, are the conversations within these silos, as I like to call them, tend to only communicate within themselves rather than sort of cutting across boundaries, cutting across disciplines, and also cutting across geographic areas, neighborhoods, communities of interest.
I find that those kinds of conversations can be confusing to people. When you start to cross silos, cross boundaries, it's almost as if you fit easily into no conversation. What are you experiencing at Urban Omnibus? Are you finding that, in fact, you're attracting readers and participants on the site from all of those disciplines?
Absolutely, and not only from the disciplines, but from probably the most important community of interest, which is urban enthusiasts who don't see themselves or identify as change agents themselves, but are the kind of people for whom the city and urban life gets under their skin and are fascinated by it. And particularly in New York, you'll find people for whom the city is certainly a subject of fascination, if not obsession. But oftentimes, I think there's a frustration on the part of urban enthusiasts who find it exactly the opposite, that some of the most interesting things that are happening across the city are not really being communicated to the widest possible audience or in ways that actually make them, as you suggest, sort of accessible and useful to the general interest observer of city life. So we find a great deal of participation coming not just between different people who are professionally involved in various design disciplines or in various fields of urbanism, but also people who just really love the city.
Now, New York, of course, is a city that is still filled with competitive media, old media and new media. Where do you see yourself as fitting into that vast array of media sources, which are focused in many cases on design, on architecture, on landscape design? So what do you do that's different?
Well, I think there are a couple different ways to answer that question. The first is sort of a methodological point, which is that, you know, you mentioned both old media and new media, and one of the main premises upon which Urban Omnibus was established was to try and bring some old media rigor back to bear on the wealth of opportunities that new media presents. So what that means is creating work that, just like an old-school mainstream print publication, is fact-checked, well-researched, vetted, synthesized, and all of that good stuff is a well-crafted piece of media in its own right, presented with a certain authorial rigor, but at the same time is presented simultaneously alongside lots of other different media sources and really harnesses some of the energy of Web 2.0 without trying to be as new media as possible. I find that a lot of the newest forms of communication are participatory to such a point that it has a lot of the vitality and energy that everyone observes when they talk about the internet, but lacks a lot of that good old-fashioned old media rigor that I think there's a lot of place for. Another way to also answer that question is not the methodological point, but just in terms of, as you asked, how it's we situate ourselves. And I see us as sort of trying to redress this large gap that I see between the way in which architecture is talked about in, say, your average newspaper, which continues to sort of treat it as an aesthetic object primarily, and treats architecture as an object sort of without regard for the social processes that happen in and around the built environment. And then on the other hand, you have like the city section or the metro section, which treats the built environment as mostly just a backdrop in which human interest stories occur, but the actual choices that layer upon each other to make the built environment are short shrift, I think, in a lot of communication strategies, old media and new media alike. So we see ourselves in terms of situating us in that landscape as trying to really take the best of both those elements, which is commenting and communicating and telling stories about the widest variety of urban interventions and transformations that are happening all across the city, but do so in a way that doesn't communicate them at the expense of really talking about design decision making.
What are the most important design issues in New York today?
Well, for me, I think the most important issues in New York today are a lot of the same issues that are facing cities and all design disciplines across the nation, which is sort of how are we going to heed the call for greater coordination across agencies, across design disciplines, across communities. I think that it's all well and good for people like me to say coordination is good and coordination is something we all must try and achieve, but it's pretty difficult. And I think it's up to a lot of cities to innovate in this regard. And New York is certainly, I hope, will be chief among those in terms of being paradigmatic in coming up with new structures for coordination across the issues that link infrastructure, mass transit, housing for the non-rich. Those are not new things to call out as issues, but I think really, really, really thinking outside the box in terms of how to coordinate across those different priority areas is for me the biggest challenge, because it's certainly not as easy as it is to talk about, to actually do it.
No, it's not. Obviously, development has slowed down everywhere, including in New York. Does the slowdown give us an opportunity to catch our breath and figure out how to do it better next time?
I hope so. I think that you will see a lot of different responses. I mean, I think one of the opportunities that I think is inherent in this particular economic challenge that we're facing right now is that there are a lot of innovators who have a lot more time on their hands than they did. And I think one of the ways that I hope this economic crisis will reinvent the ways we think about small actions that we each of us do as individuals is that the wealth of expertise that a lot of the professionalized design communities have at their disposal, I don't think needs to exclusively be applied in a you know, traditional client consultant, one's an architect and one's a rich private homeowner model anymore. I think there are a lot more ways for people who have a particular interest in their community, whether or not they're a trained designer, to actually use the fact that we all have a little bit more time on our hands to do something useful, to make a difference in a small way in our community. So I hope that, I don't know, that doesn't really answer the question of if as a society and as a city there are moments for a greater sort of collective reconsideration of priorities. I hope that will certainly occur too. But for me, I think the small scale opportunities just in terms of individuals being able to hopefully, you know, take, if you've been laid off, don't stop being involved, essentially.
What do you make of the fact that Mayor Michael Bloomberg continues to announce these street design innovations like the remaking of Times Square?
I think it shows that he continues to listen to his incredibly innovative and visionary commissioner of our city, DOT, Jeanette Zadeh Khan, who I think is, as far as I can tell, universally praised, at least in most of the conversations I've been having of late, in really having a strong vision for the streets of New York and making them accommodate all different stakeholders, which oftentimes I think a lot of the conversation about making our streets more bicycle friendly, making our streets more pedestrian friendly, eliminating congestion, they tend to pit cars against people as if cars are going to, you know, magically go away and everyone will be all the better for it. That's sort of not really feasible in a city like New York. But so I think what it takes, again, is a careful consideration of how do you coordinate priorities across all those different stakeholder groups, bicycles, pedestrians, and cars. So I think that Bloomberg's continued effort to have some small-scale interventions that really will hopefully be paradigmatic and keep the conversation going, I should say, about what the proper balance is between different modes of transport, I think shows
and,
that.
And for our listeners who do not know, tell me what's planned in Times Square.
In both Times Square and Herald Square, which are two of the most trafficked areas of Manhattan, a reorientation of how cars get through there. So essentially barring cars from the places that are at present the most congested along Broadway. And, I mean, there's been a lot of press about how this might be a sort of reinvention of the pedestrian malls that didn't work in a lot of downtown revitalization schemes in the last 30 years. The difference being that Times Square is obviously world famous, but Herald Square also, these are places that have a tremendous amount of pedestrian traffic and a tremendous amount of ground floor retail. So there is a real walking and biking constituency there that will keep these places, they're not going to become dead pedestrian malls that don't have pedestrians and don't have the retail to support a really active street life. I think, in fact, they have both those things in spades.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that because I have a Pittsburgh architect friend who sent me an email last week on the plan, and she was appalled that the mayor was proposing to remove cars, given what, in her view, was the utter failure of most pedestrian malls in America. I push back, citing Lincoln Road in Miami Beach and
absolutely,
Nicollet Mall in Minneapolis. What are your thoughts on the advisability of removing traffic from streets? Works in some places, doesn't work in other places. What's the difference?
I think the difference is if it has enough pedestrian activity to support a really active street life. The point of removing cars shouldn't be to deaden the streets of activity, but rather to reactivate them in new ways. So in order for them to be reactivated in a way that is pleasant and the way that is conducive to all of the things that, you know, need to happen to make street life active, there needs to be existing traffic. Lincoln Road is an excellent example. I mean, I would say Burlington, Vermont, I think Church Street is another example of something that is works very well because people are already walking in those places. There are reasons to be there on foot. I mean, Times Square is, you know, one of the most photographed and tourist-frequented places that is really emblematic of New York in a lot of ways. And so there's a vibrancy there that's actually been threatened by the amount of congestion of vehicular traffic. I think that when you try and remove cars from places that are really active thoroughfares that require vehicular access, in places where there's not a lot going on to attract people on foot anyway, then of course they're going to be a failure. But that is not the case with Times Square and Herald Square, which are really good places to start something like this because there is so much pedestrian traffic. And right now, up until recently, the vehicular traffic has been prohibitive to a lot of the vital street life that could occur.
I was actually pushed off the sidewalk last time I was walking in Times Square just because of the crowds. It was It was a little scary, actually.
Yeah, there are a lot of people there.
Yeah. You had a recent blog post on Post-it Notes for Neighbors. I loved that idea. Tell me how it works.
Post-it Notes for Neighbors is a brilliant project by a graphic designer and public artist named Candy Chang. It's really quite simple. She launched this public art presentation in a storefront in a Brooklyn neighborhood where she used the fact that there's this burning question in every New Yorker's mind, which is, how much do our neighbors pay in rent? And just came up with this very low-tech, very material, very sort of physical, on-the-street way to present this information and ask this anonymous question that people really answered. And then she got all this data, which people wrote on these sticky notes on a storefront in the Carroll Gardens neighborhood of Brooklyn, and made some charts and graphs and, you know, sort of presented the information. But what I think was really effective about that particular post is the fact that that's just one example of a fun and whimsical and interesting public art piece. But what it really demonstrates goes far beyond the sort of experience of that particular information-seeking exercise in terms of how much our neighbors pay for rent, but rather works, I think, quite well as a provocation of how could we use information exchange in public space more effectively so that it's not exclusively used as the highest price flyer gets the best real estate on the scaffolding, which is oftentimes the only information exchange that happens as we walk down the street is people who either legally or illegally tag the built environment, especially scaffolding, with graffiti or post flyers, which are exclusively in terms of commercial advertising. And there are many, many, many other ways that we could use some of the interstitial and transitory spaces of our city to actually ask questions that might be useful in terms of really simple stuff. A lot of the stuff that in many cases is duplicated on the internet in terms of what's happening in my neighborhood, where's the best place to buy this particular product, or what are the neighbors' reviews of this particular restaurant. Not all of that needs to take place in a dematerialized virtual realm. I think what Candy Chang's post-it note for neighbors really shows is that there is a role for that kind of communal intelligence and information sharing to be played out in the material world of the city, which really gets to a lot of the one of the key objectives of Urban Omnibus is not, even though it's an online project, is to create media that actually encourages a greater intimacy with the decision-making that, as I say, layers upon itself to create this physical environment that we all love so much. And I think that there's a lot of, hopefully, a fostering of a greater intimacy with the choices that are happening out there that get people out into the city to experience a neighborhood they haven't been to before or a new way of looking at what goes on to make the built environment what it is. So it's not exclusively to be consumed online, but actually to hopefully encourage people to get out and explore.
Earlier this year, you posted some interviews with architects who answered the question, what does New York City need to do in terms of architecture and planning to sustain itself as a world capital? What is your answer to that question?
I think I would say what New York needs to do is to continue to do a lot of the things that it has been doing, but to do so, again, with a greater sense of urgency about the needs to create new structures for coordination across agencies, across priorities. A lot of places where there's a real room for innovation within that objective of coordination is in information exchange and in encouraging the city to look inward for some examples of tremendous innovation that could be either scaled up or transported to other parts of the city. I mean, we have a huge city here where there's a tremendous amount going on, and this sort of gets to another one of the key objectives of Urban Omnibus, which is to really try and take a look at all the wealth of exciting, innovative, interdisciplinary projects that are happening that really are at this crossroads of design and the public sphere and the physical environment of the public sphere, to really learn lessons by looking inward as well as by looking to examples outside of the city. I mean, a key thing that our DOT commissioner, Jeanette Sadiq Khan, has said is, okay, it's all fine and good for us to articulate a vision of pedestrianized spaces, but this is not Copenhagen and it's not Amsterdam, and it has its own specific challenges and specific geographical vagaries that we need to take into account when choosing how to innovate. And I think that's a really important lesson for not just for New York to sustain itself, but for all cities to look inwards as well as looking for examples externally.
You have posted to your website a narrated slideshow of a walk around New York with Richard Sennett. Were you on the walk?
Yes.
I'm jealous. Did you see anything through Richard's eyes that you had not noticed before? It's a really nice narrated slideshow. I love it.
Oh, good. I'm glad. Yes. I mean, Richard and I go back a long time. I was actually his teaching assistant when I was in graduate school. But I'm consistently amazed that every time I do walk around the city with him, I do see something new, and I do see something new through his eyes. And I think what was particularly striking on that particular day, I mean, the purpose behind what I hope will become a series of walks with urbanists of all different disciplines is that we read them in books, sometimes we read their policy statements, sometimes we read some really interesting thoughts in novels, but rarely do we get a chance informally to ask questions that encourage them to just confront the details, the physical details and the material details of daily life. And that particular instance, it was very interesting because that was the first place Richard wanted to start his walk on the first place where he moved as a young music student in 1962. And so it was really, really interesting to have the combination of a nostalgic discussion, which really, you know, there were a lot of meandering anecdotes about memories of urban change and things that he remembers from the mid-60s in the Far West Village. But then when I asked him, how did this influence the urbanism, the great urban text that you would then go on to write after having lived here? And he said a really interesting thing, which I think is a lesson for all of us who are really serious about cities, which is what I learned from living here was the notion that details of material, details at the smallest scale can really make or break urban scale propositions. I think what started that whole line of thinking was a conversation about movable street furniture in a little park that we walked by. You know, and that's a classic example of how a certain kind of flexibility can really, really, really change the entire experience of a place. And if you apply that same lesson of details making or breaking urban scale propositions, as he puts it, there are a lot of lessons to be drawn for how we can think big by looking closely.
It's been a real pleasure to talk with you. I love what you're doing at Urban Omnibus, and I appreciate you being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Qasem Shepherd is the project manager of the Urban Omnibus, a project of the Architectural League of New York. There's a link to his site on our site, smartcityradio.com. His interview was recorded by Andrew Krivanos. And now, for the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Planetizen.
In the latest reaction to the hobbled economy, the state of Florida has announced plans to break up a state agency tasked with managing growth. Oversight legislators say is holding Florida's economy back. The proposal up for consideration this week would dismantle the Department of Community Affairs and redistribute its responsibilities to Secretary of State Kurt Browning. The St. Petersburg Times reports that the plan is one of a handful of measures aimed at loosening development permitting rules. The hope is that lifting growth management policies and other restrictions will allow projects to move along more quickly and get money back into the state's economy faster. But critics argue that the plan is more of the same bad policy that wrecked the economy in the first place. Speculation-based development that has left more than 300,000 homes empty or foreclosed in Florida alone. And it's not just homes that are facing abandonment. Commercial real estate is also emptying out across the country, and cities are taking the hit. A recent article from Business Week looks at the spreading scourge of vacant retail properties, and finds that as the recession bears down, cities are going to see more and more of their commercial-based tax revenue disappear. From cities to suburbs, the retail drain is widespread and growing. Property taxes are often the major source of revenue for cities, so as retailers and businesses drop out of the market, cities' budgets will likely end up being the biggest losers. And that's a trend many expect to continue for at least the next year. As a result of these dwindling coffers, some are predicting a radically different look for cities in the near future, especially public spaces. An article in Brand Week is predicting that as the economy tightens up and city budgets drop, more and more municipalities will start to warm up to the idea of allowing advertising in public spaces. It's an easy way for cities to make money, and an appealing draw for advertisers who can get their names or products in front of a large audience for a relatively low cost. From vinyl-wrapped ad buildings in L.A. to corporate-named transit stops in Chicago, cities are looking for new ways to rake in some extra cash. Some cities have even begun selling ad space on the outside of school buses. And though the extra money is more than welcome in struggling cities, many critics are uneasy about these publicly owned places and services being handed willfully into the hands of the private sector. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen.com. Coming up after the break, we've heard about the design of a city, but what about meta-design? We'll speak with Dr. Richard Farson about his book, The Power of Design. I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. My next guest is not a designer. Dr. Richard Farson is a psychologist. He's also an author and lecturer and educator and the president of the Western Behavioral Sciences Institute. But his latest book is all about design. The Power of Design, A Force for Transforming Everything, is a call to action for designers in all fields to use their skills for the good of everyone. Dr. Farson, you take great solace in the promise of designers to change our world for the better, but didn't designers give us the world we have?
That's a very good point. Yes, indeed. And if you ask most designers, they would tell you that the designs that have dominated our lives have essentially been negative rather than positive on our futures. And so they're the first to admit this, and they're embarrassed about it, but they would probably defend themselves by saying, well, I just did what I was paid to do. And of course, that's the problem. If you're a professional, and designers, I think, are part of the best profession there is, you don't necessarily work just for the person who's paying you. You work for your clients, of course, but you have to be sure that your professional judgment is being exercised. And that's a problem if you think that you only have to do what the person who's paying you tells you to do. Then, of course, you wind up not exercising your judgment. You have to realize that no matter who is paying you, you're always working for the public. If you do an ugly building or an environmentally reckless one or one that actually destroys community rather than builds it, then you have cost a lot of us a serious amount of money. And not just money, but it's also trouble.
Well, you certainly make a valid point. What is going on in the design world today that would change their behavior from what they've been producing to this new professional attitude of working also for the public?
Well, I think that there is something stirring now in the field that makes people in the design professions, and I think in each one of them there's some evidence that there's a feeling, a new movement stirring to create a more responsible approach to fixing the world. Now, I can't say that that's very strong at this time, and in fact, if you look at what most professional societies are trying to get their people to do, they're trying to get them to be more like businesses, more working for clients, and doing what is called commoditizing. That is, you make yourself into a saleable commodity and you try to convince people that they need to buy your services. And that has, of course, corrupted a lot of professions. Take broadcast journalism, for example. It changed from being a cost center for these broadcasters to a profit center. Now it has to make money. And so what we are getting is commoditized broadcast of news. And that means that, for example, one of my favorite examples is that when the Downing Street memo came out, that was the British memo that was about our falsifying the intelligence to lure them into the Iraq war. That received a total of six news segments on all three of our commercial networks. And at the same time, the Michael Jackson trial was taking place, and that received 465 news segments. And that's what I call commoditization, where you are only interested in what the market wants rather than what the public needs. That's very different. That's the difference between a business and a profession. A business does have to pay attention to what the market wants and tries to meet that want. The profession has to think first of what the public needs and has to be sure that they're always meeting that level of consideration.
Now, you are a psychologist, not a designer. Why did you write a book on design?
That's because if you're a psychologist or a social scientist, you realize that the most powerful determinants of behavior are not personality or character or history or any of the other things that we typically deal with. they are the situations in which people find themselves. That is, if you know a lot about the person's test behavior and history and their habits and their character and so forth, and I know about the situation they're in, I'm going to do a better job of predicting what they're going to be doing than you will, because situations are overwhelmingly powerful. That's what really is determining in life. And that's what designers do. They create situations. They don't maybe think of it that way, but that's when they design a building, they're really designing an organization. Or when they design a room, they're designing experiences and relationships and so forth. They can affect the experiences people have in life, and those are what determine our behavior.
You use a term, meta-design. Explain what you mean by meta-design and its significance.
A meta-design is a design that follows essentially the same goals that other design do, but it deals with more fundamental problems. So it's the same kind of science as the other design, but tries to confront things that matter more to us at a more fundamental level. For example, it's the difference between designing for the public and of designing for a private business. And so meta-design is one which is calls upon us for a higher order set of responsibilities and for a better understanding of the more fundamental problems in the world and our ability to address those.
Describe what you believe is the meta-design challenge for America.
Well, as you may know, the great issue about subsidy, a lot of it is about taking care of our infrastructure. They call it the roads and the bridges and so forth. But our infrastructure is much stronger than that and much bigger. It has to do with all of the institutions that make our society work. And so if we simply go ahead and repair the streets and bridges and so forth, that won't really do much for us. We have to really think about redesigning the infrastructure. And so if, for example, we simply build the same prisons that we've been using, housing thousands of inmates, we'll have the same increase in crime that prisons produce. We know from social science that if we keep the prison population to about 18 rather than 3,000, that rehabilitation is not only possible, but it's likely. And if we design our hospitals that with people able to see natural foliage through a window, they get well sometimes it's 3 days sooner than they would otherwise. If we redesign our schools and our transportation systems, we can do a lot. But, you know, our transportation system now there are 6 million car crashes a year in the United States. 2 million people are injured in those, and 40,000 are killed. We can do a lot better than that with rail travel and with other means of avoiding collisions. And so there's a lot of redesigning of our basic infrastructure that could make life a lot better for us. But if we're also talking about social designs, about education, then we can really make a big difference. And my hope is that designers will come to see that there really is no line of demarcation between the physical design and the social design that accompanies it.
Well, certainly, I couldn't agree with you more. However, it's been interesting even listening to the discussion of the stimulus. In the popular press, highways and bridges, no one questions. Tax cuts are good. Everything else is questionable. And when you raise your hand and say, we need shovel-ready projects, you know what happens. You get what you got, right? You get what you already have, because those are the things that are shovel-ready. It's sort of the only thing that's in the hopper is what we've always done. So how do you get new designs, redesigns in the hopper?
The fact is, if we're really just going to build the same roads and bridges that we have had, we are going to not have the kind of success as a society that we really need to have. That is a very big drag on our society. It's not that it's fine. Roads and bridges are just fine. They really aren't. We've been subsidizing automotive travel for a century now, and that is that's not been a very good thing for us. It's occupied an enormous amount of our time and reduced our productivity a lot. It has caused us a lot of pain and difficulty, and it's produced shopping centers, and shopping centers have destroyed communities. Highways have gone through communities and destroyed them. When you destroy a community, then you lose all of the things that you really need. Crime goes up, divorce goes up, child abuse, everything goes up when you don't have community. And we lose sight of that because we're so enamored of cars and the speed with which they go and the acceleration they give us. So even if we design a car that will get 80 miles to the gallon, we can't sell it because the market wants more acceleration, more size, more comfort. And so the hybrids that are made are essentially have come back down into what we've been used to for most other cars. So they're not much better than the standard cars in what they're able to produce in mileage. So it's a very serious problem, and it's not addressed because, of course, the automotive industry is an immense part of our economy. And so they have a lot of control over our politicians and a lot of our beliefs, because they produce a lot of very impressive advertising and so forth. And designers help in all that process, I have to say. And so it's not that we are, that the designers are without part in this this drama. But if you look at what social scientists study, there have been countless books written about the damage that the automobile has done to our society, that is not done when you have, for example, societies that are built on more rail travel, as they do in Europe and other places.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Richard Farson of the Western Behavioral Sciences Institute. We're talking about his latest book, The Power of Design, A Force for Transforming Everything. Your criticism of the institutions and sources we normally look to for public policy leadership is quite pointed. Why don't government and professional societies, universities, and think tanks deliver better ideas?
Any institution that has to stay in business, in other words, has to keep going forever, for example, like a university. A university has to organize itself so that it will last forever because it has to honor its degrees, its tenure commitments, and so forth. And that's why it's not generally the place for the most creativity, because creativity involves a lot of innovation, risk-taking, and failure, and so forth. So it's no accident that the great ideas, the great civilization-changing ideas, have not come from people who were at universities at the time. They come from the people like Darwin and Freud and Marx and so forth, that may have been at universities at some point, and they may have come back to them, but at the time of their greatest work, they weren't at universities. And that's because it's difficult to do that kind of extraordinary creative work, which is always met first with ridicule, then with hostility, and then finally grudging acceptance. And that you don't do at universities, and you don't do it in professional society, which are also geared to last forever. And unfortunately, the professional societies in design have been convinced that their people are really better off if they go into business than if they do what designers thought more about in 100 years ago, when they were able to be leaders in our society, and when they belonged to the great the great organizations, and they were tremendously influential in those days. Now they think they're gaining respect by being licensed and getting awards and so forth, but that doesn't actually work the way people think it does. And so it's unfortunate, and I'm very anxious to see design get restored as a profession and designers come into the leadership roles that they are really especially well qualified to take once they make the effort.
Is there something then that should take their place? Can we institutionalize it, or can we institutionalize the redesign, the meta design process that you advocate in your book, The Power of Design? Or is it, you cited a number of great creative individuals like Darwin, and is it simply up to the non-institutionalized individual?
Yes, I think it is up to individuals. I think it's up to our educational institutions to try to produce a new kind of education. As a matter of fact, one of my friends, Tom Fisher, who's dean at the University of Minnesota and dean of the College of Design, is advocating that there be something like public architecture. That is, in the same way that medicine has a branch called public health. I do know that there are people thinking about that now. There's a San Francisco organization called Public Architecture that is considering working on such a graduate degree in architecture.
You include a chapter in your book that you call Designs for the Liberation of Children and Youth. What do children and youth need to be liberated from?
I used to think that liberation would apply to people you feel sorriest for. And then I discovered that that's not the way it is at all. The people who need liberation most tend to be people you don't feel sorry for at all. Most of the white people didn't feel sorry for black people. They thought they were happy in their place. Certainly most of us didn't think that women needed liberation. They were adored, and they had lots of money and so forth. And we just thought, well, what could they want? And then I realized that it's not that way at all. And I began to look at children, and I looked, if it's true for women, let me look at the condition of childhood. Because when I looked at the condition of women in America, then I realized, holy mackerel, this is a very, very different situation than I thought. And children are tremendously discriminated against in our society, in every imaginable institution, and in every way. They are demeaned and resented. The ones that go to jail stay in jail longer than adults do for the same crime. You go to jail for crimes that aren't even crimes if adults do them, like truancy and so forth. So there's a lot of discrimination against children, and nothing is designed for children. They're designed out of places. If you look at the way in which everything from our commercial institutions to our restaurants, traffic systems, and so forth, we make them so children can't function effectively, and we've forced children into situations where they aren't mobile. Their parents have to drive them around everywhere now, which is a pain for the parents. And so we've designed them out, and we've made parenthood a very difficult time, and that's actually made life more dangerous for children, believe it or not. There's a study in London where they were wondering why it is that children are getting killed more often, twice as often now, as pedestrians than they used to be. And what they found out was that children are not learning to cross the street because they're being taken across the street by their parents. And isn't that interesting? I found that quite an interesting.
Very. yes. I resonate with that. Well, you've talked about big ideas, meta design, big idea. And you've talked about at least one place where you see change could be underway, and that's in the university. And you cited specifically public health as a model for, say, public design or public architecture. Any other seeds that you see being planted that you think are moving us in the right direction to this broader idea of meta design?
Oh, yes. I think there are a number of them. There is an organization that is resisting the building of prisons now. They are a group of different professions of design that have taken a stand against building any of the kind of prisons we're now building. There's a group called Architecture for Humanity, which addresses only the kind of problems that reduce people's poverty and their suffering. There's in this organization in San Francisco, Public Architecture, they've gone to a lot of businesses and asked them to give pro bono 1% of their effort to do something that would serve the public. That may be, for example, the poor people who are waiting for jobs at street corners can collect and they give them more of a depot in which they can be more comfortable and not be suffering the way they do and so forth. There's just a lot of good things going on. Nothing like what there should be going on, but it's not that there's no effort taking place here.
Richard, it's been nice to talk to you about your book, The Power of Design, A Force for Transforming Everything. Dr. Richard Farson, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Well, thank you.
Dr. Richard Farson is the president of the Western Behavioral Sciences Institute. His interview was recorded by Carrie McCall. We have a link to his book on our site, smartcityradio.com. Finally this week, our City Views commentator Walker Smith reminds us that sometimes the best thing that can happen is nothing at all.
There was a day last month when I had a very unusual 24 hours. I flew to Minneapolis from Atlanta one night and then flew home the next day, and nothing bad or strange happened to me. It was almost surreal. I made 4 appearances in 2 different airports and was on 4 different planes, yet nothing untoward happened to me. Now, to understand my amazement, you have to realize that I've been on planes 2 to 4 days every week for the past 25 years. Just about everything that can happen to somebody in a plane or in an airport, or airport parking lot, or hotel shuttle bus, or airport baggage claim, or airport taxi stand, or hotel valet lot, or airport bar, or you name it, has happened to me. With a few exceptions. I haven't been on a plane that had to make a crash landing in the Hudson River, but I was on a plane that once made an emergency brace-for-impact landing in Greenville-Spartanburg after it lost an engine mid-flight. Fortunately, our landing was smooth, but there was foam on the runway and a line of fire trucks awaiting our arrival. I haven't slept on the floor of an airport during a blizzard, but I have been stranded overnight in Manhattan without a hotel room during a driving rainstorm with gale-force winds, and on one snowy night in Charlotte, my flight was turned back just after takeoff, and I only got 2 hours of sleep in a dismal motel bed before having to rent a car for an hours-long drive home along an icy interstate with only one lane open. I haven't had my bags lost by an airline while on a long trip, but I have forgotten to collect my hats, gloves, laptops, Walkman, pens, and calendars from planes, taxis, airport lounges, and airport newsstands. I've left home without every sort of toiletry or article of clothing you can imagine. About half of the ties I own are ties I've had to buy in airports or hotels. And I haven't ever been turned away at airport security, except for that one time back in the days before TSA, when a security supervisor said I needed a doctor's statement to come through with my insulin pump. That was completely wrong, of course. So I just went to the security entrance on the other side of the airport and went through there to my flight. Of course, that's not the only argument I've ever gotten into with security. I think I probably had arguments at virtually every airport in America, by which I mean every big one, plus lots of smaller ones like Jackson Hole, Flagstaff, Charleston, and Rochester, Minnesota. These arguments are always about silly things like nail clippers, extra power cords for my laptop, whether my shoes go in or out of a plastic bin, or whether or not artichoke relish is a proscribed liquid or gel, or just a wet vegetable. I've gotten to the point where I come to airports expecting the worst, resigned to the hassles. But on this trip in January, nothing. It didn't last, of course. It was right back to hassles the next day. But it did give me hope that maybe one day I could get a streak going like that of more than just one trip in a row. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of the Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He joins us each week from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his latest book is Generation Ageless. Want to check out the Urban Omnibus or find out where to see The Power of Design? Join us at smartcityradio.com. You can sign up for our newsletter, subscribe to our podcast, and find out more about our guests and their fascinating work. You can also click on the contact button or send us an email at questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer. He's wondering, what's the opposite of ne'er-do-well? I'm Carol Coletta.